Welcome to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, Arts Editor of the TLS. Thea Nadutzi, our usual host, is not back with us yet, so we're very pleased to welcome back Toby Lichtig, our fiction editor, to hold the line. Hello, Toby, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you, Lucy. How are you doing?
All right, thank you very much. You've been, since you're a fiction editor, you've been reading anything interesting lately?
I have, as a matter of fact. Not just fiction as well, but I've been doing quite a lot of reading. My book on the go at the moment is the new Richard Powers novel, Bewilderment, which is out later next week, and we're actually running a review of it in a couple of weeks' time. And I can exclusively reveal is on the Booker shortlist. It's exclusive at this second, at the time of recording. Unfortunately, by the time this goes out and our listeners will be hearing this, it will no longer be exclusive, but there you go.
We can enjoy the thrill of exclusivity now.
You heard it here first, Lucy. So that's on the Booker shortlist. I think Richard Powers is a wonderful novelist. His previous book, The Overstory, did extremely well as well. He's very engaged with science. All his books have some kind of scientific theme, ecology, neurology. And actually, he's incredibly good at narrative too. So he is one of those authors who does a huge amount of research, but then at his best, where's that learning likely? The new novel, Bewilderment, is about this father-son relationship, and that really is actually at the heart of it. It's just this very beautiful relationship between this guy who's lost his partner and he's bringing up this slightly troubled 9-year-old boy. He's also an astrobiologist, and his speciality is life or the potential for life on other planets. And it's really, really beautifully done.
Do you know, if you had asked me what I was reading, which I'm sure you would have, because you're very polite, I'm actually reading The Overstory, like about 5 years too late, or, you know, however many years
never too late
it is. It's just brilliant.
Yeah.
The Overstory is basically about trees. I mean, generally, also people, but a lot of
But really about trees a lot.
And it's wonderful because he manages to do that thing, as you say, talk about quite abstract things and people thinking hard and sometimes reaching moments of transcendence. It's very difficult to write about that without sounding boring or preachy or kind of hand-wavy. And I just find it just absolutely gripping. And you keep wanting to tell people about bits that you've read.
I mean, and he does a really interesting thing with The Overstory, doesn't he? Because he decenters humanity. It's, you know, suddenly you realise that...
I haven't finished it yet. No.
Well, it's you know, in most novels, humans are really the main part of the story, aren't they?
Yeah.
And there's this whole new wave of fiction in the era that we currently are living in, the climate crisis, where novelists are actually trying to bring non-human organisms into the kind of narrative, not just as a backdrop, but as, you know, narrative itself. And I think he does that really effectively with The Overstory. And I think when we look back, we'll see that as, you know, one of the kind of the early lodestars of this new sort of fiction. But I massively recommend Bewilderment. I mean, I'm not surprised it's been shortlisted for the book, and I think it's a worthy contender.
Yeah, that sounds terrific. Well, we're going to be talking about more books coming up on this week's show. What to read this autumn, the big hitters, the new voices, and the Booker shortlist. And two very different readings of The Stonehouse Affair, the story of the MP who tried to leave it all behind. But first, let's see if this sentence chimes with you at all. As I tried to heave a 10-kilogram power bag over my head, I didn't have the heart to tell the trainer that I rarely lift more than the 2-volume Oxford English Dictionary. This week in the TLS, we're reviewing books about fitness, how it came to be the industry it is, what it means to us, even what the smell of sweat does. Irina Dumitrescu has gone on this desk-bound journey for us. We didn't make her go to the gym for research, I promise. And she has written brilliantly about it. We're delighted that she's here to talk about it today. Irina, many thanks for joining us.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
So at the start of your piece, you recount your own experience of joining a gym, which was motivated, you say, partly by an ideology. Can you tell us about that ideology and about your experience at the gym, if you like? You don't have to reveal anything you don't want to. That's fine.
Well, I have to say, I actually enjoyed being in the gym because I was so invisible. There were all these men around me who were looking at themselves in the mirror. So I could just enjoy watching them enjoy themselves. So that part of it was entertaining. But I think, you know, obviously I went to the gym because I wanted to be trimmer and be healthier. But in the back of my head, there was also this feeling that people who exercise regularly, and not just when it sort of presents itself, are people who are more disciplined, who have more control over their lives. And for them, exercise is a kind of basis for success in their career, for a happy family life, and so on. So there was this idea in the back of my head that if I got that part of my life in order, if I could be fit in one area, I would be fit in other areas as well.
You do hear that, don't you? Especially with, I remember with, this was a while ago, I think it was Condoleezza Rice, and somebody did like her usual day, and she got up at like 4 a.m. and did 2 hours of weights and then practiced Bach at the piano for an hour or something. And you got the idea, just to make everyone feel completely kind of puny and incompetent. I mean, a lot of the discourse around it has become about improvement and efficiency and competition, hasn't it?
When did politicians start actually need to be seen jogging? Because that didn't happen sort of 50, 40 years ago, did it? How did that actually start, that whole Condi Rice or pre-Condi Rice thing, where you had to have images of your president or prime minister in their jogging gear running around Central Park?
Well, I think Ronald Reagan must have been a big part of it. He had this, he publicized his exercise program, which he jokingly referred to as pumping firewood. And he described himself as this sort of outdoorsy man who liked to do, you know, ride horses and chop wood and so on and stay fit. So it seems to definitely go back as far as the 80s. And you could almost say the apogee is Arnold Schwarzenegger becoming governor of California, right? That's where exercise and politics meet in their most ideal form.
In their purest form. And now you have, yeah, President Putin bare-chested,
yes,
on top of huge horses and kind of wrestling animals and things. And the idea about it being about efficiency and competition and all that, it, according to the author of the first book, you considered it's all Darwin's fault, isn't it?
Or a misreading of Darwin. Jürgen Matschukat talks about the way that Darwin developed this theory of evolution through fitness. But fitness at the time only meant appropriateness. It just meant that a particular species did well in a certain set of conditions at a particular time. And, you know, this is how I learned evolutionary biology in university too. There's nothing better about one quality or another. It's just what helps you survive long enough to reproduce in one environment. But fitness started to change in the 19th century and started to mean strength, vigor, right? It started to mean something absolutely good. So Darwin wouldn't say, you know, you have to be buff. You just have to be good enough to have babies in the place where you are. His theory got taken up and kind of twisted a bit by various 19th century thinkers. And I think also in the popular sphere.
It's a wonderfully literal misreading, yeah, because for Darwin, it was something like what your wingspan was or whether, you know, you could work out how to crack the nut or something, wasn't it? And it turned into the biggest and the strongest almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And Matschukat doesn't make it particularly clear where exactly this shift happens, but his point is more that there are various discourses happening in the 19th century that lead to this, right? That there's a growing sense that people are responsible for their own self-improvement. There's a focus on education, also education on the of the masses. So this version, this kind of adapted version of Darwin, it's really a little more like Lamarckian evolution, this idea that you constantly strive to be better and better and better, that seems to be in the air in the 19th century in the West and takes over and kind of takes Darwin's ideas and uses them to strengthen this notion that people have to fight all of the time to improve themselves and to become more competitive.
And this urge is also sort of compounded and driven by industry and nations, in fact, isn't it? It's a desire to keep the workforce and also the army fit and productive and ready to fight, as it were.
Yes, and one of the things I found most surprising in Matschukat's book was how early we have things like work-sponsored exercise programs. So as you're having industry take off, business owners realize that working on a factory line, for example, is not particularly good for people's bodies, right? This kind of repetitive motion. So they start to institute various kinds of health programs on free days, weekends, and so on to try to keep their workers' bodies fit enough, both appropriate and strong enough to do this kind of unnatural repetitive labor. Then in the mid 20th century, you see something similar, but with office work. So there's this kind of vision of the middle-aged, generally white man with a kind of with a professional job who sits in his office at a desk all day and becomes overweight, becomes unhealthy, has all kinds of problems. So I hadn't realized to the extent to which these work-sponsored health programs have such a long history. It's about a century long.
Mm. And it depends how you look at it. You could be cynical and say, well, it's because they're trying to keep everybody healthy so they can do as much work as possible. Or you can say, well, it's for the good of the workers.
Machakat is very cynical, and I have to say I agree with him on this. He's really relentlessly cynical. But he points at it at one point that self-care has become like that too. It's no longer something you do because it's good for you or because you enjoy it or because you care about yourself. But there's almost an expectation that people will engage in self-care so that they can be in good working shape for their jobs, right? Mm. It's not just our responsibility to do our jobs, but we have to maintain ourselves like a well-oiled machine in top-notch condition in our spare time so that we can do our jobs all the better.
Is that a case of mental health as well as physical health then, that kind of self-care idea, do you think?
He talks more about the body, but I think that's true. Yeah, I think there's a sense that we're responsible also for managing stress
well-being
in the workplace. Yeah. As yeah. opposed to the workplace not stressing us out.
Yeah, exactly. we have to remember, of course, I mean, of course, it's good for us to move around. Exercise is good for us. And the general idea that we might think is that our ancestors ran around all the time and that's what we should be doing. But the next book, which is called Exercised, that deals with this idea, doesn't it?
Yes, Daniel Lieberman contrasts this fantasy of the what he calls the athletic savage with what he considers the reality.
And what was the reality? He wasn't really running around all the time, perfectly exercised and incredibly healthy, was he?
Well, Lieberman both looks at archaeological evidence and studies contemporary hunter-gatherer societies. And what the conclusion to which he comes is that people were really not meant to strain themselves all that much. People do move around a lot. They do a lot of chores, kind of light work, childcare. Every now and then people might break into a run to catch an animal to eat it. But basically, humans have evolved to conserve energy, to conserve calories, because most humans and most of our history have not had a lot of calories at their disposal. So it's actually an evolutionary adaptive advantage to be able to save calories for staying alive and, again, for having sex and reproducing. These are the main main expenditures of energy. We're not necessarily evolved to go running for no reason on a daily basis.
And also, I love the fact that he said also they used to spend a lot of time sitting around. You know, there's this awful thing about you mustn't sit down, it'll kill you. But they used to sit around quite a lot, around the fire or whatever.
Well, that comes from his research on hunter-gatherer societies. And his point is that they do sit not as much as people do today in Western civilizations, but maybe as people did a couple of generations ago. So still comparable to modern sitting. But they sit differently. They don't sit in the chair with the back in one position for 8 hours at a stretch, but they fidget, they move around, they might get up to do something. So it's more interrupted active sitting, squatting, right? That's a healthier way to sit.
Yes, we should all be squatting around our desks rather than don't try this at home. Actually, do try this at home. It's fine. Try it wherever you want.
I feel so much better about fidgeting now, I have to tell you.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I love the fact you say in your piece, he makes the case for a life filled with frequent light activity rather than Iron Man heroics, for dancing around the kitchen rather than sweating till we drop, which sounds so much nicer and more fun.
I have to tell you that Lieberman's book really made me feel so much better about housework. I have enjoyed housework so much more since I read that book. And frankly, that's kind of miraculous. So I appreciate it a great deal.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And the next book, because we gave you lots of books, didn't we? The next one is about the science of sweat, which is a very human attribute, apparently, and how important it is. Can you talk us through that?
Well, what I hadn't realized before I read Sarah Everett's book was that most animals don't sweat. Dogs pant to keep cool. Vultures apparently poop on themselves in order to cool their bodies down. So it seems that we got a good deal with sweat. And again, this is one of these evolutionary advantages that human beings have, which is that we can cool our own bodies. We're really adaptable to a lot of temperatures. The big takeaway from Everett's book, however, how individual sweat is, right? Every person's sweat smells slightly different. Every person has their own composition of bacteria in their armpits and on the rest of their body. And so it's like a fingerprint. And in fact, fingerprints are traceable because of the sweat on them.
And it's also very important to our daily lives, isn't it? And can change, you said. The smell of you and the way you sweat can change through encounters with other people. Is that right?
On the one hand, sweat seems to be identifiable long term. So there are people who can recognize each other's smell after years apart, mothers and children, for example, or people who are quite close, siblings. On the other hand, there do seem to be situations where a person's sweat can change. She does talk to a sweat researcher at one point in a very strange but fascinating section. A young man who had never really had much of a bodily odor, and then he had sex with a woman, and he began to stink. From then on, he basically started to smell really, really, really bad. And he started looking into using sort of sweat transplants or bacterial transplants to change the smell of people's sweat. And he used an old t-shirt that he had that hadn't been washed to kind of reimpregnate his body with his old bacteria and return to not smelling at all. But the jury seemed to be out on whether that's something that's really possible to change the smell of your sweat. That seems to be research that's ongoing.
Right. Okay. And meanwhile, the lesson is don't take lessons from vultures on there, because that's the most gross way, as far as we can tell.
Well, there is another lesson, which is actually smell people, right? I think the part of the point is that we don't smell people very much, because in late 19th and 20th century, right, even as fitness was taking off, sweat was losing out. It became obnoxious to smell like sweat, at least in certain places. And so we often don't really encounter each other's real smells, because we encounter perfume and cologne and deodorants and things like that, but we don't smell one another. And that's a very basic form of communication. Sweat, which we're missing out on in our relationships with each other.
Mm. Okay, so the other take home is don't wash. Wash less.
Yes.
No deodorant. Yes.
Sit around and don't wash.
You heard it here first. And the last book that you reviewed for us is The Secret to Superhuman Strength by Alison Bechdel, the graphic novelist. And incidentally, she's the originator of the Bechdel test for films, isn't she? For which great praise to her, though I did learn today it was the idea of her friend, Liz Wallace, who she gives full credit for. Anyway, sorry, that's a digression. What is Alison Bechdel's attitude towards strength and fitness?
Bechdel's really interesting because she shows the tension. On the one hand, she tells the story of her life through her different obsessions with movement, with jogging, biking, skiing, karate, and I'm sure I've missed a few. Yoga, of course. So she's someone who's been drawn to physical activities throughout her whole life. And yet she's really aware of the more ominous side of it. She knows about the fascist history of idealizing certain kinds of fit bodies. And she shows herself in a way losing control in her attempt to gain control over herself. So she becomes a workaholic. She drinks a bit too much and so on, smokes a little too much pot, and also torments herself with exercise as a way almost of not dealing with her life or with her grief or with human relationships. At the same time, there are also these moments of transcendence in the book where she will be in nature and and hit a kind of flow and feel at one with the universe. So Vector really shows both sides of movement, the beautiful and the extra disciplinary.
There's also, she says, doesn't she, that she at one point she's like, I'm a feminist and I'm totally against body fascism, you know, and the way that people have kind of insisted that women look, and yet she still finds herself doing it.
Well, I think what's at the core of her desire for fitness, at least the way she describes it in the book, is almost a kind of feeling that fitness will give you immortality, right? Mm-hmm. And that if you're not disciplined, you don't deserve to live. So there's something really, I'm using the word wrong, but kind of existential about it, in the colloquial sense that run or die. Either you're a good person who has self-control and self-discipline, and therefore you can you have a right to be among others and to continue to exist, or you're just going to disappear somehow. I think that's what it is. It's about a fear of death ultimately.
Mm-hmm. And has her attitude changed by the end of it? Or that's not the point. She's just showing how she's been feeling about it.
I think by the end, she becomes a little more relaxed and she can focus a bit more on the beautiful parts of it. But she still presents it as a struggle, right? It's never something that's quite settled, but it's this kind of modern tension. What do I do with my body? What do I do with myself? How do I relate to the society around me and the demands that they make on me?
And finally, Irina, I wondered if you could just share with us the ending to your piece, because it seemed to me a source of both relief and delight, the last couple of sentences, if you've got them there.
Yes. We did not evolve to run on treadmills like lonely hamsters, but we have always enjoyed moving ecstatically in groups, touching transcendence through hours of sweaty exertion. Had I known this when I approached the gym doors, I would have turned around and gone to a nightclub instead.
There we go. That's the other take home. I mean, if you want to go to the gym, of course, if you have a nice time there, splendid. Otherwise, dance around a bit.
You can do that while dusting as well. It doesn't have to be in a nightclub.
I think I'm pushing this very hard because I'm very receptive to that idea. Others may say, no, I want to run my marathon.
Well, actually, Lieberman actually suggests that so people who run very long distances without training for them, you know, the hunter-gatherer groups who do this don't necessarily go out, you know, doing half marathons just for fun. He suggests that dancing is how they train. So all night dancing in groups is part of how they keep their physical stamina up. But it's fun. It's a fun way of training.
Well, there you go. That's how you do both. Wonderful. And Irina Dumitrescu, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come on the show, what to read this autumn, we provide an ad hoc guide. You're welcome. And we revisit the strange story of the disappearing John Stonehouse. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can follow this podcast wherever you normally get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Since we've got the fiction editor here this week, I thought I'd pick his brains for what we've got to look forward to this autumn. Toby, we talked about the Booker shortlist earlier, and we're gonna dig into it a bit more, aren't we?
We are indeed, and it's not just with me, because I'm delighted to say that our very own, if we can call her our very own, Alex Clark is joining us now. Now, Alex was originally here just to talk about our next item, but she is an expert on Booker shortlists. and she's gonna pick through it with me now, I think. So
splendid. Two experts for the price of one. That's
you
wonderful.
May indeed call me your very own.
Oh good.
Delighted to hear that.
If not yours and Lucy's, to do with as you will. Yes, I don't know about expert though, but let's have a go.
Okay, so I'm going to quickly read out the six books for listeners who don't already know. So there's Anuk Aridprakasam's A Passage North, which is set in Sri Lanka during the Civil War. Damon Galgut's The Promise, which is set in South Africa from the sort of end of the apartheid era up to the present day. Patricia Lockwood's No One Is Talking About This, the this being social media and various other currents coursing through it. Nadifa Mohammed's The Fortune Men, which involves the case of a man executed in Wales in the 1950s. Richard Powers's Bewilderment, which we did discuss earlier in the show. And Maggie Shipstead's Great Circle, which is partly set, I think, in the 50s and partly in the present day. And it reflects on, amongst many other things, the great age of aviation. So, Alex, I am pretty excited by this list. In fact, I think it's one of my favourite shortlists in recent years. I mean, there's no Ishiguro, no Cusk. A couple of people might raise eyebrows at those omissions, but I think there are six really powerful novels here. What do you think? Do you agree or do you dissent?
No, I agree. That's not going to make for very good listening, is it? I do.
Thank you for joining us, Alex. The end.
Bye-bye now.
Any omissions that you're very cross about?
Not really. I mean, I did really love Light Perpetual by Frances Spofford.
Yes.
Which
yes.
was on the long list. And I did love The Cusk and I did love The Ishiguro. Hmm. So, you know, yes, there are some things that you perhaps rather... Oh, gosh, now I think of it, I loved Sanjeev Sapohota's China Room as well.
It was a really good long list, wasn't it? I think it was the best long list in a decade for me.
Isn't it amazing that it you know, we're always talking about shortlists of various kinds as great sort of introducers, as great reading lists for people. And they really are. And I think this one is huge. I mean, there's loads of writers here. Although there's only one debut, there's Patricia Lockwood's the only debut novel, but there's several sort of second and third time novelists on here whose work I'm just not really very aware of. I mean, I haven't read Maggie Shipstead's first novel, Seating Arrangements, which people seem to adore, people who have read it. So, you know, I suppose it's really Bewilderment and The Promise, The Galgut and The Powers, are that they are the most sort of prolific, they're the most historied writers.
I do actually think, for me, the pick of the crop is the Damon Galgut. I read it a few weeks ago and I just think it is totally brilliant and beautiful and does sort of family drama against changing political backdrop so cleverly and so engrossingly. So I think that's my one. Do you have a pick, do you think?
Well, I don't know if I have a pick to win. I mean, I did because I think it's actually quite a sort of unreadable shortlist in that terms. Although I do think you're right.
Unreadable as in inscrutable.
As in inscrutable. I mean, you know, as we know, it's always a complete, you're on a hiding to nothing. I mean, I'm still dizzy with delight that Piranesi, Susanna Clarke's book, won the Women's Prize for Fiction because
yes.
I hoped it would. I thought it might, and then I was delighted that it did. And rarely do those three things come together for me. But I do think The Promise, the Damon Galgut, is in with a really, you know, strong shout. I also think Richard Powers is, because there's an awful lot of themes that cross this list, aren't they? I mean, I think it's kind of a list of the times in a way, because although there are things that are sort of very historically and geographically specific, there's a lot of loss and trauma on this list, which makes it sound like one great big sort of tear fest, and it's not. But I mean, it is really concerned with these kind of vast upheavals and how they play out in people's very specific family stories, isn't it?
Tech might be a sort of tech and the future as well are in there, as well as the past. Is that right? Is that fair or not really?
Certainly the Lockwoods, that's the sort of more the present, and the Powers, which is set, I'm reading at the moment, we were talking about it earlier, it's set sort of a few years into the future. Climate change has got even worse and the kind of political backdrop in America has got even more toxic and authoritarian. And it's also about the stars and astrobiology and future life and all the rest of it. So yeah, that looks in all directions, I'd say.
I would say Lockwood, which you're right, Lucy, has got this kind of real sort of edge of modernity and kind of madness, the madness of social media in it. But I don't know if I've ever read a book that's so clearly in two halves. And that in a way, if you haven't read it, I mean, it's a very easy book to spoil, even though it isn't a thriller and it doesn't have suspense in that sense, but it just changes. The first half is totally about internet discourse and social media discourse and what it's doing to us and celebrity. And then the second half is completely different. And I kind of think I should say no more than that, really.
Okay, well, we won't say any more about that. And now I think we will move from our fiction and our made up stories to a real story.
Yes, indeed, Lucy, we do have a real story to discuss now. From Aleister Crowley to Reginald Perrin, the pseudo-suicide or faked death has long been a source of public fascination. Who among us, when the chips are down, has not wistfully imagined concocting a story involving a flimsy vessel, an abandoned briefcase, a forged passport, and a hastily written note before heading off to the South Pacific to start life afresh? Well, perhaps that's just me. But it isn't just me. Listeners of a certain vintage will remember the Stonehouse affair, when the Labour MP for Walsall North and former Cabinet Minister John Stonehouse disappeared while swimming from a private beach in Miami. Had he drowned at sea? Had he been eaten by a shark? Weeks passed while his wife and three children back in London began adjusting to the tragic news. Then Stonehouse was spotted in Australia, living under an alias. It was a media sensation. Stonehouse, it seems, had committed fraud, theft, and much else besides. Extradition, arrest, and a trial ensued while Britain watched on agog. Two new books about John Stonehouse have recently been published, and Alex Clark has written a magnificent review of them in this week's TLS. Hello again, Alex. And am I right in saying that this story had been something of an abiding interest of yours, sort of long before you were approached with this commission?
Well, I think it probably goes to what you're saying in the intro to that I do have this sort of fascination with faked deaths. But I think actually it's specifically that it really is the first thing I remember being on the telly news. I just can remember it very, very vividly. And I think that's just kind of random in some ways. I imagine my parents were very, very interested in it. My dad absolutely loved a fake sort of a disappearance type thing. He also loved Donald Crowhurst, the sailor who sort of pretended to be going around the world or whatever he was doing. And I suppose it just lodged in my mind.
Do you remember everyone talking about it when you were little? Do you remember
I was really quite little. I mean, you know.
Yes, but I should say, this is the early 70s, isn't it?
Yeah, I was about kind of six, I guess, when this happened, six or seven. And I just suppose I saw it on the news and I just remember because it was such a kind of breathless scandal. And of course, that's part of the reason that it's endured. It's part of the fact that the trial, you know, his subsequent trial, which I've found out obviously a lot more by reading these two books than I was aware of at the time or even subsequently, was such a huge thing. You know, one of those real sort of tabloid, endless generation of news stories, partly because he was put on trial when he was finally brought back to the UK after an awful lot of wrangling, because he sort of was going to go before Parliament and then he wasn't, and he was going to be extradited and then he wasn't. There were kind of wrangles between governments. There were ways that he could, that Parliament, in a sense, because he'd been a cabinet minister in Wilson's government, Parliament could kind of almost save face and come to terms with having this absolute renegade in their ranks. So there's this long process. He finally gets back to Britain and then he's put on trial basically for fraud. Not the sort of fraud of disappearance, but the kind of financial miasma that surrounded him.
Well, yeah, let's row back a bit. Who was this man and why did he try to fake his death? What was he running away from?
Contentious. He was Labour and Cooperative MP for Walsall North. He'd been an MP for some time. I mean, he'd had some distinction. He was Postmaster General before it was, and then he worked as I think Post Office Minister or Post Office and Communications, the sort of revamped title. I mean, he'd sort of fallen from that kind of front bench role largely sort of because the Labour government had gone out of power. But also he'd had an awful lot of suspicion that he was a Czech spy, had whirled around him for some time.
Was this reported in the papers? Were the papers talking about that? Was it sort of all kind of off the record?
There is an awful lot that is off the record, actually, that remains off the record. But indeed, it was kind of paper talk a lot of it too.
Sorry to butt in, but it seems extraordinary that he carried on being an MP at all if they thought he was a Czech spy. But they're just like, oh, he might be. But anyway, on you go.
I really think there was kind of, you know, he had certain links can be made, but, you know, he was, you know, I guess kind of, you know, normal that he would have met people in different governments and different businessmen, etc.
And he obviously denied everything at this stage.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, and his daughter, who's written one of these books, absolutely continues to deny it, you know, to this day.
He did prove himself to be quite hapless, though, didn't he? Because he, you know, he faked his death and then he was almost immediately discovered. And I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that. Like, how did he get from the Miami beach to Australia? And secondly, how was it that he, you know, this is pre-internet. Well, it was probably a bit easier to just disappear in those days.
As I was reading about this and the details of it, I mean, I don't know if I quite understood it myself, because it seemed to me that, well, for a start, he did a sort of trial run. He flew to Miami and thought about faking his death and did a little bit of sort of scoping out the ground, then lost his nerve and flew back to London. And then a bit later, few weeks later, he did the same thing again, except this time he went through with it, and he'd gone off basically to try various kind of import export businesses and financial businesses, and they were all in kind of varying degrees of trouble. He went off with an associate to meet people who might be able to help him out of that trouble. And off he says to the guy, I'm going to go for a swim, see you for a drink for dinner, and never appears, having stowed his clothes in a cabana and made a big sort of fuss of saying, I'm going to leave my clothes here to a cabana attendant. But actually, I think he had some hidden somewhere behind a rock in a phone booth, I forget, somewhere, some clean, fresh clothes, and off he went. But what became extraordinary to me, that he crisscrosses, I mean, the sort of flights that he takes in a world where you couldn't just book a flight on your app really quickly. But he seemed to take immense numbers of flights to finally get to Australia. It's amazing to me that nobody recognised him, but they didn't. Partly it was because Lord Lucan had also just gone missing, so everyone was looking for him. So perhaps Stonehouse kind of faded a bit into the background. But, I mean, as in all these things, you know, people, it's the simplest things. I don't think he quite realised, or the way I read it, he hadn't quite realised how small town, in a way, Melbourne in the 70s was. So there he was going, setting up his new bank accounts in fake names, and he kind of forgot that basically one bit of bank personnel would say to another one up the road over their sandwich at lunch, you know, we had a funny guy in here this morning, he
did a fake moustache and a
yeah, exactly, you know, he seemed very sort of unclear about his documentation, and he was very shifty, but he had an awful lot of money. So this was how it came out, the fact that he tried to open his new bank accounts in his new names, and he had a number of sort of fake names, all on the same morning in the same street.
Well, that doesn't seem terribly efficient.
It's not the work of a master criminal, is it? But of course, this was again, you know, one of the things that he then came up with in his defence was that he'd essentially kind of suffered a complete psychiatric breakdown. In fact, he consulted various experts at the time, and one of whom gave him this phrase that sort of came up again and again in his defense of psychiatric suicide, that he'd become sort of essentially split into, well, not just two, but several people, but one of them was John Stonehouse, and he was sort of dead. He had to kill him.
And John Stonehouse, who'd done all the bad things.
We've done all the bad things.
He was dead.
Done, yes, exactly. But, you know, and also it had been done to him. You know, he had become increasingly beleaguered and depressed by the hypocrisy of public life, by the cant of politicians, by the fact that, you know, you had friends one minute who were your foes the next, by the sort of hideous cut and thrust of party politics. And this had all been a kind of intolerable psychiatric strain, and he had therefore split off John Stonehouse. He'd killed him, and he'd emerged reborn. One of the sort of defences that has been put forward is that, you know, he was essentially kind of stealing from himself. You know, he was sort of plundering his own bank accounts. So what crime had he actually committed? But judge and jury took a very dim view of that. I mean, I don't think it was helped by the fact that he had a defence team and basically sacked them all as well, mavericks, we might kindly say, often do, don't they? They think they can take the stand themselves and weave this wonderful tale of rhetoric and justice, and it didn't quite work. So yes, he defended himself. He gave, I found this a fascinating detail, he gave a dock statement, which is a sworn statement that you give from the dock, sort of in your defence. And so irritated was the judge at this because he just went on and on. Can you imagine? So irritated was the judge that he essentially, in subsequent years, was part of the reform of that law that meant you just couldn't do that anymore. It's as if he just like, that is enough. I'm actually changing the whole judicial system now. We can't put up with this nonsense any longer.
Gosh.
That's
Can I ask about the sort of personal aspects of it, which was that he had left a family behind, but he then set up with someone else, didn't he, when he...
Well, he'd been...
Well, when he was reborn, as it were.
Exactly. He'd been having an affair with his secretary, Sheila Buckley, who he subsequently went on to marry, and they had a son, and, you know, there was a sort of long-lasting, real love affair between them and marriage between them. But yes, he had left his wife, their two daughters and their son.
How old were the children at this stage?
They were sort of teens. I mean, the sort of young adults, his daughters were kind of grown up, and he had the younger son. But, you know, they were by no means grown up. Julia Stonehouse's book is a sort of, you know, a howl of kind of exculpation in a way. I mean, she mounts this absolutely forensic defence of her father. And I mean, impressively so. There's an awful lot of sort of research in it. And at the end of it, you kind of think, well, supposing every bit of this is true, the question that remains is, what is it like to be a child whose father fakes their own death?
Does she address that at all?
Not really, not in a kind of, you know, in any sort of, with any kind of emotional depth. And I mean, I left that book thinking, is it simply too painful to think that my father could have allowed me to continue to believe that he was dead? And similarly, the other book by Julian Stonehouse is so, so different. I mean, it's written in a much kind of racier style, in a way. He himself is a lawyer, and his father, you know, who was Stonehouse's nephew, had been sort of part of the defense team at various points, and part of his, you know, company schemes too. And I think reading between the lines, and there is a sort of afterword in which Julian Stonehouse says, you know, I came to see my father very sympathetically, and we've not always had an easy relationship. And you think there is clearly sort of rage at what this person, Stonehouse, kind of perpetrated on the wider family. The kind
we
of
know if Julian Hayes and Julia Stonehouse talk to each other, and are they mentioned in each other's books, or is it, do these seem separate affairs?
No, I believe they do not. I think there have been interviews around and subsequent to publication where they've kind of alluded to sort of sending each other, you know, notifications that they were writing books. But very little else. And I mean, this goes against the sort of conjuring of much larger family gatherings in both their childhoods, where they were supposed to be a kind of great big happy family, with Stonehouse in a way not exactly at the centre of that, but certainly this kind of provider of large homes and largesse and sort of magical childhood times. And then of course this, you know, they'd all just disappeared. And there is that thing that just came to me, you know, as I was reading, specifically, I suppose, Julian Hayes' account of that idea of a person who puts themselves at the absolute centre of the family, and their actions make them the person that everyone talks about and thinks about and worry about and be angry at, and what then happens to everybody on the periphery. And I found that kind of fascinating, actually.
It is fascinating, you know, 50 years later,
yes,
it's still haunting the family, you know, they're still Absolutely. Raking over this, and it's really, really interesting. You just said that Julia Stonehouse's
version sort of posits him, in your quote, as an honourable man brought low by intolerable pressures. And obviously Julian Hayes's book gives a far more warts and all account, I guess. Which one did you buy? Which Stonehouse do you come away with from reading these two books?
I think it's very, very hard to read this story and believe the kind of totally innocent version. But I think you come away, you know, with an idea of somebody as a chancer, really. I have to say, I think I thought, wow, he's, you know, he was a kind of self-mythologizer. And then it all got too much. And I think in a way it's, you know, I can buy his daughter's version of him as having had a kind of breakdown. But I think a breakdown that essentially meant that he just didn't really know what he was doing is a bit harder to buy because of the you know, the extraordinary lengths that he went to create this sort of, you know, the lies and deceit. And I think one of the things that enormously went against him in the trial, certainly in terms of public opinion, and what absolutely does in terms of reading these accounts now, is that when he was setting up these two fake identities, and he'd done loads of prep work, you know, getting passports and the like, because of course he had to have those details to do his sort of international travel. But he went to constituents, two women whose husbands had died, and he'd found out from sort of local information, actually not by totally legit means then, I don't think, and he went to them and basically said, don't worry, I'm going to get some charitable help for you. I just need to take away various papers belonging to your dead husbands. And so this sort of plundering of dead people's identities, you know, doesn't really go into the kind of, you know, oh, it all became too much for me. But it's so interesting that, you know, we became so, at the same time there was Lucan, of course. Lucan had done something far, far, far worse. And then what pops up on our tellies not very far after is Reggie Perrin, which had initially been knocked back by the BBC for not being topical or believable. But of course, Reginald Perrin is a kind of tremendously benign version of all these other disappearers, isn't he? Because he really does just sort of have enough and do, apart from that, he does briefly allow his loved ones to think he's dead. He has a much more sort of utopian vision of how he wants his new life to be.
I think we're going to have to disappear now, aren't we? Because we're running out of time.
But in a completely straightforward and open manner.
Straightforward and open manner. And we
not by leaving a pile of clothes on the beach. Because that really, I don't know if anybody ever did that again. I mean, I know, of course, you know, in latter years, there's been sort of, you know, the famous canoe man.
Canoeist John Darwin, who I did want to talk to you about. But
everybody thinks, well, if I am going to fake my own disappearance, the last thing I should do is just neatly fold a pile of clothes, because that has been done, as it were, to death.
Well, we are all fully clothed, and nonetheless, we will.
I think you shouldn't need to point that out, Toby. I think we should take that as a given.
It's worth saying.
We're chatting to each other. Down the line, you have no idea.
It's been so brilliant talking to you, Alex. Thank you very much indeed.
Absolute
for coming pleasure. On.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Irina Dumitrescu and Alex Clark. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Lee Meyer. We'll be back next week, but for now, goodbye.